A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. First half of chapter 5. Writers who have rendered women objects of pity, bordering on contempt. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. We now have to examine the opinions on the female character and education that have been plausibly argued for in some modern publications, and have given the tone to most of the briefer and more casual things said about the sex. I shall begin with Rousseau, giving a sketch of the character of women in his own words, and interspersing comments and reflections. My comments will all spring from a few simple principles, and could be derived from what I have already said, but his argument has been constructed with so much ingenuity that I think I have to attack it in a more detailed manner, and make the application of my principles myself, rather than leaving it to the reader. Sophie, says Rousseau, should be as perfect a woman as Emile is a man, and to make her so, he has to examine the character that nature has given to the female sex. He then proceeds to argue that woman ought to be weak and passive, because she has less bodily strength than man, from which he infers that she was formed to please him and be subject to him, and that making herself agreeable to her master is the grand purpose of her existence. Still, to give a little mock dignity to lust, he insists that when a man goes to a woman for pleasure, he should not use his strength, and should depend on her will. So we deduce a third conclusion from the different constitutions of the sexes, namely, the stronger should be master in appearance, but should depend on the weaker in fact. This is because of an invariable law of nature, which goes like this. Nature gives woman a greater ability to arouse desires in man than it has given man to satisfy them. So it, nature, makes the man dependent on the good pleasure of the woman, and forces him to try to please her in his turn, in order to obtain her consent that he should be stronger. On these occasions, the most delightful circumstance that a man finds in his victory is to be unsure whether she has yielded to his superior strength, or whether her inclinations spoke in his favour. The females are usually artful enough to leave this in doubt. Women's understanding in this matter corresponds exactly to their constitution. Far from being ashamed of their weakness, they glory in it. Their tender muscles make no resistance, they pretend to be unable to lift the smallest burdens, and would blush to be thought robust and strong. What is the purpose of all this? Not merely for the sake of appearing delicate, but also to prepare the way for being feeble whenever that suits their purposes. If Rousseau is right about woman's duty, if pleasing man is the iron bed of fate that her character should be made to fit, stretching or contracting it, regardless of moral and physical distinctions, then it does indeed follow that woman ought to sacrifice every other consideration to make herself agreeable to man. But I think it can be shown that practical rules built upon this ignoble base would undermine the purposes of even this life as distinct from the afterlife, and that gives me room to doubt whether woman was created for man. If the cry of irreligion, or even atheism, is raised against me, I will simply declare that if an angel from heaven told me that Moses' beautiful, poetical account of the beginning of the world and of the fall of man is literally true, I still couldn't believe what my reason told me was derogatory to the character of the Supreme Being. And having no fear of the devil before my eyes, I venture to call this a suggestion of reason, instead of resting my weakness on the broad shoulders of the first seducer of my frail sex. Here is Rousseau again. Once it has been demonstrated that man and woman aren't and oughtn't to be constituted alike in temperament and character, it follows, of course, that they should not be educated in the same manner. In pursuing the directions of nature, they ought indeed to act jointly, meaning that their sexual intercourse ought to be a collaborative enterprise. But they shouldn't be engaged in the same employments. The final goal of their activities should be the same, but the means they take to accomplish them, and thus their tastes and inclinations, should be different. Men depend on women only because of their desires. Women depend on men because of their desires and also because of their needs. We could survive without them better than they could without us. For this reason, the education of women should always be relative to men, to please us, be useful to us, make us love and esteem them, educate us when we are young, take care of us when we are grown up, advise us, console us, make our lives easy and agreeable. Those are the duties of women at all times, and what they should be taught in their infancy. Whenever we lose touch with this principle, we run wide of the mark, and all the precepts that are given to them contribute neither to their happiness nor to ours. Girls are from their earliest infancy fond of dress. Not content with being pretty, they want to be thought to be pretty. They are to be governed by talking to them of what people will think of their behaviour. This thought, this control device, works with them almost as early as they are capable of understanding anything that is said to them. But it doesn't have the same effect with boys. They don't care much what people think of them, as long as they can pursue their amusements without interference. Time and care are necessary to get boys to be motivated by the thought of what people will think. This first lesson, wherever girls get it from, is a very good one. As the body is, in a way, born before the soul, our first concern should be to care for the body. This order, body first, then soul, is the same for both sexes, but the object of that care is different. In the male sex it is the development of bodily powers, in the female sex the development of personal charms. I'm not saying that either strength or beauty should be confined exclusively to one sex, but only that the priorities for them should be reversed in the two sexes. Women certainly need enough strength to be able to move and act gracefully, and men need enough skill to be able to act with ease. Here, then, we see a basic propensity firmly established. All you as parent need to do is to go with it and regulate it. The little girl will doubtless want to know how to dress up her doll, to make its sleeve knots, its flounces, its headdress, etc. She needs a lot of help from members of the household, so much help that it would be much more agreeable to her to do all this for herself. That provides a good reason for the first lessons that are usually taught to these young females, in which we seem not to be setting them a task, but doing them a favour by instructing them in something immediately useful to themselves. They nearly all learn, with reluctance, to read and write, but they very readily apply themselves to the use of their needles. They imagine themselves already grown up, and think with pleasure that such qualifications will enable them to decorate themselves. This is certainly an education only of the body, but Rousseau isn't the only man who has indirectly said that merely the person of a young woman, without any mind, is very pleasing. To make it weak and what some may call beautiful, the understanding is neglected, and girls are forced to sit still, play with dolls, and listen to foolish conversations. And this conduct produces in them a result that is insisted on as an undoubted indication of their nature. I know it is Rousseau's opinion that the first years of youth should be employed in forming the body, though in educating Emile, he deviates from this plan. But the body strengthening, on which strength of mind largely depends, is very different from the body strengthening that enables the person to move easily. Rousseau's observations were made in a country where the art of pleasing was developed only so as to make vice more elegant. He wouldn't have drawn these crude conclusions if he had gone back to nature, and his thinking about it hadn't been disturbed by his dominating sex drive. In France, boys, and especially girls, are educated only to please, to manage their persons and regulate their exterior behaviour, and their minds are damaged at an early age by the cautions they are given to guard them against immodesty, some of the cautions being worldly, some pious. In past times, the confessions that mere children were obliged to make, and the questions asked by the confessors, I have good authority for this, were enough to impress a sexual character, i.e., to reinforce the society's idea of femininity in the girls and its idea of masculinity in the boys. The education of society was a school of flirting and the skilful management of the other sex. At the age of 10 or 11, even sooner, indeed, girls began to flirt and to talk, without being reproved for it, of establishing themselves in the world by marriage. In short, almost from their very birth, they were treated like women, and were given compliments instead of instruction. Compliments weakened the mind. When society treated girls in this way, it was assuming that nature acted like a stepmother when she formed this afterthought of creation. Because it did not grant that girls had understanding, however, society was obliged in consistency to subject them to some authority independently of reason. And to prepare them for this subjection, Rousseau gives the following advice.
As well as being active and diligent, girls should be early subjected to restraint. This misfortune, if that's what it is inseparable from their sex, and if they ever throw it off, they will suffer evils much crueller than that. They must throughout their lives be subject to the most constant and severe restraint, which is that of decorum. So they must get used to it early, so that it won't hit them too hard later on. They should also get used to the suppression of their caprices, so that they will be readier to submit to the will of others later on. Even if it is work that they are most fond of, they should be sometimes compelled to lay it aside. If their upbringing is too permissive, their basic propensities will give rise to dissipation, frivolity, and inconstancy. To prevent this abuse, we should teach them above all things to restrain themselves properly. Our absurd institutions reduce the life of a modest woman to a perpetual conflict with herself, though it is fair that this sex should share in the sufferings arising from the evils it has caused us.
And why is the life of a modest woman a perpetual conflict? Because this very system of education makes it so. Modesty, temperance, and self-denial are the sober offspring of reason. But when sensibility is developed at the expense of the understanding, such weak beings must be restrained by arbitrary means, i.e., not by nature, but by rules devised by humans, and so be subjected to continual conflicts. Give their activity of mind a wider scope, and nobler passions and motives will govern their appetites and sentiments, and this government will be less conflicting, because it will come from within the woman rather than from the outside. Rousseau says,
"Women ought not to have much liberty. When something is permitted to them, they are apt to indulge in it excessively. Addicted to extremes and everything, they are even more carried away in their diversions than boys."
Well, slaves and mobs have always gone to excesses in that way, once they have broken loose from authority. The bent bow straightens with violence when the hand that is forcibly holding it is suddenly relaxed. And sensibility, which is the plaything of outward circumstances, must be subjected to authority or moderated by reason. Rousseau continues,
"This habitual restraint makes women tractable in a way that they'll need throughout their lives. They are constantly under subjection either to the men who are their partners or husbands, or to the opinions of mankind, and they are never permitted to set themselves above those opinions. The most important qualification in a woman is good nature or sweetness of temperament, formed to obey such an imperfect being as man is. Often full of vices and always full of faults, she ought to learn even to suffer injustice, and to bear her husband's insults without complaint. This is for her sake, not his. If she becomes stubborn and hostile, this will make her husband worse."
The being who patiently endures injustice and silently puts up with insults will soon become unjust, i.e., unable to tell right from wrong. Anyway, the factual premise is wrong. This is not the true way to form or improve the temperament, for in general men have better temperaments than women, because they are occupied in pursuits that interest the head as well as the heart, and the head's steadiness gives a healthy temperature to the heart. People of sensibility seldom have good temperaments. The formation of the temperament is the cool work of reason, which brings jarring elements in the person's makeup into harmony as the person grows older. I never knew a weak or ignorant person who had a good temperament, though the constitutional good humour and the docility that fear causes in the behaviour are often called good temperament. Note, causes in the behaviour, because genuine meekness reaches the heart or mind only as an effect of reflection. The simple restraint arising from fear produces a number of unpleasant moods in domestic life, as many sensible men would agree, after finding some of these gentle, irritable creatures to be very troublesome companions. Rousseau goes on to argue,
"Each sex should preserve its own special tone and manner. A meek husband may make a wife behave badly, but mildness of disposition on her part will always bring him back to reason, at least if he isn't absolutely a brute, and will sooner or later triumph over him."
Perhaps the mildness of reason might sometimes have this effect, but abject fear always inspires contempt, and tears are eloquent only when they flow down fair cheeks. A heart that can melt when insulted, and instead of revolting at injustice, can kiss the rod, what materials can it be made of? If a woman can caress a man with true feminine softness at the very moment when he treats her tyrannically, isn't it fair to infer that her virtue is built on narrow views and selfishness? Nature has never dictated any such insincerity. You may call such prudence a virtue, but morality becomes vague when any part of it is supposed to rest on falsehood. These are mere expedients, and expedients are only useful for the moment, whereas the good in virtues is everlasting. Let the husband beware of trusting too completely in this servile obedience, for if his wife can sweetly caress him when she is and ought to be angry, she may do the same after parting with a lover. These are all preparations for adultery. If fear of the world or of hell restrains her desire to please other men when she can no longer please her husband, what alternative is there for this being who was formed by nature and art only to please man? What can compensate her for this privation? Where is she to look for a fresh employment? Where can she find sufficient strength of mind to decide to begin the search, when her habits are fixed and her chaotic mind has long been ruled by vanity? But this biased moralist, Rousseau, makes a plausible case, based on his own system, in favour of cunning. He says,
"Daughters should always be submissive, but their mothers should not be inflexible. To make a young person tractable, she shouldn't be made unhappy. To make her modest, she shouldn't be made stupid. On the contrary, I would quite like it if she were permitted to use some skill, not to escape punishment if she has disobeyed, or to avoid the necessity of obeying. Subtlety is a talent that is natural to the female sex, and in line with my view that all our natural inclinations are right and good in themselves, I hold that subtlety should be cultivated along with submissiveness, modesty, and so on. All we need is to prevent it from being abused."
A little later, he triumphantly proclaims,
"Whatever is right."
Granted, but perhaps no aphorism ever contained a more paradoxical assertion than this. It is a solemn truth with respect to God. He sees the whole at once, but man, who can inspect only the disconnected parts, finds many things wrong. and it is right that he should try to alter what appears to him to be wrong, even while bowing to his Creator's wisdom and respecting the darkness he is working to disperse. Given the principle that whatever is right, Rousseau is correct in what he infers from it. He says,
"The female sex's superiority in address, in skill and ingenuity, is a very fair payback for their inferiority in strength. Without this superiority, woman would be man's slave, not his companion. It lets her preserve her equality and govern man while she pretends to obey. Woman has everything against her, our faults as well as her own timidity and weakness. She has nothing in her favour except her subtlety and her beauty. Isn't it very reasonable that she should cultivate both?"
Greatness of mind can never cohabit with cunning or address. Those words really refer to insincerity and falsehood. But I shan't go on about that. I merely point out that if any class of mankind is so created that it has to be educated by rules that aren't strictly deducible from truth, then virtue is an affair of convention, a mere construct of human arrangements. Men have superior strength of body, but if it weren't for mistaken notions of beauty, women would become strong enough to be able to earn enough to live on, which is the true definition of independent, and to bear the bodily inconveniences and exertions that are needed to strengthen the mind.
Rousseau again.
"Beauty can't be acquired by dress, and flirting is an art not so early and speedily attained. But even when girls are young, they can work to have agreeable gestures, pleasing tone of voice, an easy way of walking and moving, and skill in gracefully suiting their looks and attitudes to time, place, and occasion. I would like a young English woman to cultivate her agreeable talents in order to please her future husband with as much care and persistence as a young Circassian woman cultivates hers, so that she will be ready to be in the harem of an Eastern potentate. The tongues of women are very voluble. They speak earlier, more readily, and more agreeably than men. They are accused also of speaking much more, but so they should, and I am willing to convert this reproach into a compliment. Their lips and eyes have the same activity as men's, and for the same reason. A man speaks of what he knows, a woman of what pleases her. The man's speech requires knowledge, the woman's requires taste. A man's discourse should aim mainly at being useful, a woman's at being agreeable. Their different conversations should have nothing in common but truth. We should restrain the prattle of boys with a severe question, 'What is the purpose of what you are saying?' But for girls' prattle, we need a different, though equally difficult question. How will what you are saying be received? In infancy, when they can't yet tell good from evil, girls ought to observe it as a law, never to say anything that the listener will find disagreeable. Not an easy law to obey, and made all the harder by having always to be subordinate to the former law against ever telling an untruth.
To govern the tongue in this manner must require great address indeed, and it is too much practised both by men and women. How few people speak out of the abundance of the heart! So few that I, who love simplicity, would gladly give up politeness for a quarter of the virtue that has been sacrificed to it. Politeness is an equivocal quality which at most should only be the polish of virtue.
But to complete the sketch, I quote Rousseau again.
It's easy to see that if male children can't form any true notions of religion, those ideas must be thoroughly out of the reach of female children. For that very reason, I would begin talking to them about religion earlier, if we waited until they were able to discuss such profound questions in a disciplined way, we would risk never speaking to them on this subject. Reason in women is practical reason. It enables them to use skill in finding the means of achieving a known end, but could never enable them to discover that end itself. The social relations between the sexes are truly admirable. what results from their union is a moral person of which woman could be called the eyes and man the hand. From the man, the woman learns what she is to see, and from the woman, the man learns what he ought to do. If woman could get back to the first principles of things as well as man can, and if man could go into details as well as woman can, neither would depend on the other for anything. They would live in perpetual discord, and their union could not survive. But in the harmony that in fact naturally exists between them, their different abilities carry them towards a single goal, and it's hard to say which of them contributes more. Each follows the impulse of the other, each is obedient, and both are masters. Just because a woman's conduct is subservient to public opinion, her faith in matters of religion should be subject to authority. Every daughter ought to be of the same religion as her mother, and every wife to be of the same religion as her husband. Even if the religion she acquires is false, God does not see her acceptance of it as wrong behavior, because of the docility that induces the mother and daughter to submit to the order of nature. As they can't judge for themselves, they ought to abide by the decision of their fathers and husbands as confidently as by that of the church. There's no great need to explain to women the reasons for their religious belief, but there is a need to state precisely the tenets they are to believe. A creed that presents only obscure ideas to the mind will lead to fanaticism, and a creed that presents absurdities will lead to loss of faith. Rousseau's wish to make women physically attractive and obedient, rather than thoughtful and self-controlled, is based on his view that a woman should be her husband's mistress for as long as possible. This whole emphasis in Rousseau reflects the daydreams of fancy and refined licentiousness. The man who can be contented to live with a pretty and useful companion with no mind has lost, in voluptuous gratifications, a taste for more refined pleasures. He has never felt the calm and refreshing satisfaction of being loved by someone who could understand him. In the society of his wife, he is still alone, except when the man is sunk in the brute, the lower animal. "The charm of life," says the grave philosophical reasoner Adam Smith, "is sympathy. Nothing pleases us more than to observe in other men a fellow feeling with all the emotions of our own breast." But, according to the line of thought by which women are kept from the tree of knowledge, the important years of youth, the usefulness of age, and the rational hopes of a future life are all to be sacrificed to making woman an object of desire for a short time. Besides, how could Rousseau expect them to be virtuous and constant when they aren't allowed to base their virtue on reason or direct their inquiries towards truth? Rousseau's errors in reasoning all arose from sensibility, and women are very ready to forgive sensibility to their charms. When he should have reasoned, he became impassioned, and his thoughts inflamed his imagination instead of enlightening his understanding. Even his virtues led him astray. Born with a warm constitution and lively imagination, he was naturally drawn toward the other sex with such eager fondness that he soon became lascivious. If he had given way to these desires, the fire would have extinguished itself in a natural manner. But virtue and a romantic kind of delicacy made him practice self-denial. Yet when he was restrained in his behaviour, by fear, delicacy, or virtue, he let his imagination run riot, and the glowing images that it came up with sank deep into his soul. And he has depicted his warm feelings so warmly that readers' hearts have been drawn in and their imaginations inflamed. The stronger the reader's imaginations are, the more sure they are that they have been convinced of something intellectually, when really they have only shared the feelings of a poetic writer who skilfully exhibits the objects of sense, voluptuously shadowed or gracefully veiled, and by thus making us feel, when we think we are reasoning, he leaves a deposit of error in the mind. Why was Rousseau's life divided between ecstasy and misery? It has to be because the effervescence of his imagination produced both. If he had allowed his imagination to cool,
he might have acquired more strength of mind.
But peace to his spirit. I am at war not with his ashes, but with his opinions. I am fighting only the sensibility that led him to degrade woman by making her the slave of love. Let us, my dear contemporaries, rise above such narrow prejudices. If wisdom is desirable on its own account, if virtue, properly so called, must be based on knowledge, then let us try to strengthen our minds by reflection, until our heads become a balance for our hearts. Let us not confine all our thoughts to everyday trivial occurrences, or our knowledge to an acquaintance with our lovers' or husbands' hearts. Rather, let the carrying out of every duty be subordinate to the grand duty of improving our minds and preparing our affections for a more exalted state. If we really were created only to flutter our hour out and then die, then let us give full play to sensibility and laugh at the severity of reason. Yet even then, this wouldn't be satisfactory, because we wouldn't have strong bodies or minds, and life would be lost in feverish pleasures or wearisome idleness. But the system of education that I earnestly want to see exploded seems to presuppose something that ought never to be taken for granted, namely, that virtue shields us from the casualties of life, and that fortune, slipping off her blindfold, will smile on a well-educated female, and bring in her hand an Emile or a Telemachus to guide her. The facts are quite contrary to this. The reward that virtue promises to her devotees is confined, it seems clear, to their own bosoms. They must often contend with the most vexatious worldly cares, and endure the vices and humours of relatives for whom they can never feel a friendship. Many women, instead of being supported by the reason and virtue of their fathers and brothers, have strengthened their own minds by struggling with their vices and follies, but they have never met with a hero in the shape of a husband. If they did have a husband, he might manage to bring their reason back to its natural dependent state, and restore to man the privilege of rising above opinion, the privilege that had been usurped by the woman. End of the first half of chapter 5.